The existence of such a criminal organization as Cosa Nostra is frightening. This organization attempts to be a form of government unto itself and outside of the law. This tightly knit association of professional criminals demands and gets complete dedication and unquestioned obedience of its members to orders, instructions, and commands from the ruling authority or the boss or bosses thereof. Family, religion, and country are all secondary and required to be subservient to the interest of this vicious criminal syndicate.
The Cosa Nostra, the United States Senate investigates. NBC News presents one of a series of special programs on the Senate investigation of the nationwide crime syndicate known as the Cosa Nostra, the mob, the syndicate. Here's NBC correspondent Robert McCormick.
Chairman McClellan today again took his investigation subcommittee into the bloody maze of organized crime, inspired by information furnished by one Joseph Valachi, a member of the crime syndicate Cosa Nostra. Valachi turned informer because he himself was afraid of the murderous disciplinarians of his own organization. Valachi is serving a 20-year narcotic sentence and a life term for murder committed in prison when he thought a fellow inmate was the gang executioner commissioned to kill him for violating Cosa Nostra rules. The huge Senate caucus room, the scene of many past McClellan investigations, was crowded, but reporters, television cameramen, and photographers perhaps outnumbered the spectators. McClellan and his committee will again talk to Valachi tomorrow in secret. Friday, the historic stool pigeon is scheduled to take the stand in an open hearing, but he is reported to be balking unless granted immunity from crimes he might be involved in by his own testimony. Today, McClellan laid out this course for the investigation.
During the course of these hearings, we intend to examine the nature of criminal organizations. We hope to determine whether existing laws are sufficient. We will give attention to the question of whether law enforcement agencies need more authority. And I may say personally that I have in mind a statute to deal directly with and to prohibit membership in such a criminal secret organization as Cosa Nostra. We hope the hearings will serve not only to provide material and information for legislative study and guidance, but that it also will alert the people of our country to the magnitude of this problem and prompt greater cooperation and assistance to law enforcement agencies by individual citizens.
First witness was a former counsel for the committee, Attorney General Robert Kennedy.
The picture is an ugly one. It shows what has been aptly described as a private government of organized crime. A government with an annual income of billions, resting on the base of human suffering and moral corruption. In 1957, more than 100 top racketeers met at the now infamous crime convention at Apalachin, New York. But until 1960, the federal government had only the barest shreds of evidence about what happened at that meeting. A number of the delegates, including those from Chicago, escaped detection. Federal investigative agencies are now pooling information on more than 1,100 major racketeers. Because of the investigative vigilance possible as a result of this intelligence effort, such a meeting could not occur unobserved today. Because of intelligence gathered from Joseph Valachi and other informants, we know that Cosa Nostra is run by a commission and that the leaders of Cosa Nostra in most major cities are responsible to the commission. We know that membership in the commission varies from 9 and 12 to 12 active members, and we know who the active members of the commission are today. We know that in the past 2 years, at least three carefully planned commission meetings had to be called off because the leaders learned that we uncovered their well-concealed plans and their meeting places. We know that the commission makes major policy decisions for the organization, settles disputes among the families, and allocates territories of criminal operation within the organizations. For example, we now know that the meeting at Apalachin was called by a leading racketeer in an effort to resolve the problem created by the murder of Albert Anastasia. The racketeer was concerned that Anastasia had brought too many individuals not worthy of membership into the organization. To ensure the security of the organization, the racketeer wanted these men removed. A particular concern to the racketeer was that he had violated commission rules in causing the attempted assassination of Frank Costello, deposed New York rackets boss, and the murder of Anastasia. He wanted commission approval of these acts, which he has received. We know that the commission now has before it the question of whether to intercede in the Gallo-Profaci family gangland war in New York City. Gang wars produce factionalism, and continued factionalism in the underworld produces sources of information to law enforcement. Indications are that the gangland leaders will resolve the Gallo-Profaci fight. The casualty list of this one gang war alone offers a somber illustration of how cruel and calculating the underworld continues to be. Since the summer of 1961, there have been 5 persons murdered and 13 persons seriously injured. 10 of these were shot and 1 nearly strangled, 1 beaten in a New York nightclub, and 1 beaten and then thrown from a speeding car. I might say, Mr. Chairman, that both the Gallos, Larry and Joe Gallo, appear before this committee, as did Mr. Profaci. Such violence is not limited to New York. There have been gangland murders There have been 37 gangland murders since 1960 in Chicago alone. And in the Youngstown, Ohio area, there have been 70 bombings since 1950. We know that Joseph Magliocco, who has taken over in Brooklyn, a successor to the recently deceased Joseph Profaci, has not been confirmed by the commission and will probably not be. This is despite the fact that Magliocco recently sought the support of the commission, members Angelo Bruno and Steve Magadino. We know that while Vito Genovese is in federal prison, Thomas Eboli is substituting for him in New York, and Jerry Katina is doing the same in New Jersey. Because of the power that Genovese wielded within the organization and the fear in which he is held by the New York organization, no move has been made to take over the top spot while his appeal on a narcotics conviction is pending in the courts. If Genovese stays in prison after his case is concluded, we anticipate a major underworld struggle in New York.
New York Police Commissioner Michael Murphy said law officers are hindered by the lack of cooperation from those who deal with hoodlums, sometimes union or business leaders in a labor dispute, or gamblers or entrepreneurs who find they can get money from racketeering loan sharks. He suggested a nationwide clearinghouse to gather criminal intelligence. Next came the colorful testimony of New York City's Deputy Chief Inspector John F. Shanley, head of the Criminal Investigation Bureau.
The organized crime rulers, as exemplified by these 5 families which will be under scrutiny during these hearings, have had relatively long reigns. The stability of command, frustrating to the police, must be puzzling to the public. These overlords have remained in their position of power despite ruthless and ambitious underlings on the one side and a full might of the federal, state, and municipal enforcement on the other. This can be accounted for, to a degree, by certain tactics, methods of operation employed by them. Law enforcement efforts on the fringe of these kingdoms have had some success. However, police progression towards the core of this subculture is hard going, and the nearer the heart, the tougher the coverings. This condition, unfortunate for law enforcement, is achieved through various measures. All have evolved from experience, all are employed in one form or another by each of the 5 families, and all have proven successful. Some of these shields are in the form of tasks performed by subordinates. Others are variations on traditions, and still others, adaptations of practices used either in business or affairs of the state. Among these protective measures are the following. Insulation. Every lawbreaker tries to avoid arrest. These efforts usually become more concrete and complicated in direct proportion to the prestige and cunning of the perpetrator. The top ranks of these families seldom become involved in crimes in such a manner that would subject them to embarrassment, much less arrest. Their personal conduct is free of obvious misdeeds. Social associations are generally very restricted, and contact with actual lawbreakers is non-existent. Routine observations of their lives would indicate, for the most part, exemplary conduct. Of necessity, as the levels descend, the members get closer to the operations and become increasingly vulnerable to police activity. But the descent is deep in the pyramid and a long way from the top. Specific plans and devices are used, but basically the strongest insulation is supplied by a philosophy which permeates the group. That is, the boss must be protected. Inculcation of this thinking on the membership has been highly successful. Whether in the younger men, this stems from the hope that such sacrifices in the beginning will eventually afford them similar comfort, or in the case of the older men who have never advanced, this thinking has become a part of a way of life, or whether it's a combination of fear and the traditional distaste of informing cannot be firmly stated. But it is this philosophy that gives the strongest protection to the hierarchy of these infamous families, and it is a philosophy which has produced 30 years of silence, the witness to be heard being the only one who dared to abandon this credo. Respect. Another inviolate rule is a requirement that there must be a strong sense of respect for leaders and traditions. This is beyond merely protecting the boss. It exceeds deference due any leader, and it is not confined to ordinary bowers and scrapers present in all organizations. This is respect in the true sense of the word. With relations to individuals, it seems to be achieved partly by position and partly by seniority, with stress on the former. Although all things being reasonably equal, the older member has more prestige. Among some older men, it involves hat-tipping and bowing, reminiscent of royalty, but usually it is less courtly, although by no means subtle. It is unmistakable. A member's position and the value of his accounts will appear, in many cases, to be enhanced by age per se. Perhaps old age, under these circumstances, is a superior achievement in itself. In public places, the reflex responses triggered by the need to comply with this code have been beneficial to law enforcement. The terms of address, the tone of voice, the held door, the proffered seat, and demeanor generally frequently reveal status in different groups. Based on these observations, it is easy to believe that the neglect of such niceties might well bring severe discipline to the offender. A number of sleepers, high-ranking members previously considered possessors of routine membership, have been uncovered from deep probes started by displays of this nature, the buffer. As has been said, the top members of this evil group, as a rule, do not mix or even do business with their immediate subordinates. They deal through a buffer, usually around the same age, who is carefully selected and highly trusted. When traveling, they generally have this person with them. This underling acts as an aide, but he is no menial. He drives the boss when necessary, but he is not a chauffeur. He handles messages from the field, but he is not a messenger. He discusses problems with the boss, but he is not a counselor. He would fight for his boss, but he is not a bodyguard. He travels with the boss socially, but he is not his equal. He performs a variety of functions, none overtly criminal, although no doubt he furthers many a conspiracy. The buffer's main duty is to stay between the boss and trouble.
Then Shanley detailed the organization's disciplinary techniques.
All disciplining of members of these tribes, no matter how barbaric, including murder, is done within the same house or family, by their own members. Thus, if a family member has violated the rules or refused to abide by a superior's decision, he must be punished. This punishment varies from a warning, through cutting him out of some lucrative endeavor, to the ultimate, murder. Keeping the killing within the family eliminates the development of vendettas, makes it easy to perform the task, and paves the way for the disappearance. It has been the experience in New York City that murders of mob members have been performed by fellow members of the same family. Almost without exception, any other recent racket-type killings in New York City have been committed by mavericks, spontaneously, or by people outside of the family. A disappearance. Sometimes a sit-down decides murder is the only solution to the problem discussed. As mentioned, the homicide is assigned to the member of the mob to which the victim belongs. Within a short time, the man disappears. In five instances in the last 3 years, a member and usually his car have vanished without a trace. These obliterations were carried out by Judases, friends, possibly actually blood relatives, completely trusted by the victim. The victim showed no fear, no change of routine prior to his disappearance. His technique has great advantages. There is no apparent violence, no sprawled body in a bullet-punctured car, no gruesome pictures, no inflamed press in public. Usually, sometime after the victim was last seen, he is reported as a missing person in the jurisdiction in which he resides. Frequently, this is a small town adjacent to the city. But regardless, there is no body and no complaint of homicide. The case is carried as a missing person, a disappearance.
The committee counsel put a question to Shanley.
You discussed the credo of not informing.
That is
now, how strong is this credo in this organization?
Well, as strong as life itself in this organization.
What is the penalty if a man talks?
Death.
You're convinced of that?
I'm convinced of that.
And you know of instances where such thing has happened?
Numerous instances, yes. There have been exceptions where it hasn't happened, which is hard to understand, but almost without exception, this is what happens.
Yes. This is probably one of the strongest strengths of this organization.
That is true.
Is that correct? Now, yes.
On that point, that might be interesting to all of us. I notice what you said about movers of money, speaking in large sums, etc. Can you give us any order of magnitude, for example? What are we dealing with here in terms of...
Well, I would say that one particular man that we have a very close observation at right now, and I wouldn't want to disclose his name, I would estimate that he has $1 million out in Shylocking at one point a week, which gives him $10,000 a week from this alone. And these are not... a number of loans. These are generally confined to 50, 100,000 paper along those lines.
Well, would you have any estimate of the annual volume of this hierarchy that we're talking about?
Now, that'd be pretty difficult, Senator.
I just thought to get an order of magnitude, it might be.
I would say that possibly in the gambling field and policy alone, just what goes to the hierarchy here would run $250,000 a day.
$250,000 a day.
A day.
I can't do quick mathematics, but have you thought through what that means a year?
Well, I guess it'd be about a 6-day week. It'd run to $75 million or thereabouts.
Now, is that the whole country, or?
That's New York City.
New York City.
Shanley is asked just exactly how the crime bosses insulate themselves from detection.
Well, we have, in relation to the insulation, I think that a study of the arrest records of the people that will appear on this chart is one of the greatest indications of how effective insulation is. Most of these people start off with a series of arrests when they're young men. They are arrested for various types of crimes. And then as they go on and become a little bit older, these arrests cease. Now, a man who does not get up in the rank, he continues to accumulate arrests, but these other people go sometimes 20, 25 years without an arrest. This is because they've been removed from the operational level. Somebody else is taking the risk. They're out of it. Then in relation to other efforts at insulation, most of these people that you will speak of that are top level no longer live in New York City. We have no idea that they are not controlling a lot of things in New York City, but they don't live there. They live in, one fellow lives way out of the state, another fellow lives in New Jersey. Two of them have residence of sorts in New York, but their most substantial residence are a considerable distance from New York. Nonetheless, they're so insulated, we find it hard to even observe these people.
In other words, they have several layers of people between the perpetrators of the crime, the people that give those people the orders, who in turn get orders from others and so forth, up to the buffer.
That is right.
Attorney General Kennedy sums up what all this means to us, to just ordinary citizens.
For if one thing is clear, it is that organized crime is a national problem. The racketeer is not someone dressed in a black shirt, white tie, and diamond stick pin, whose activities affect only a remote underworld circle. He is more likely to be outfitted in a gray flannel suit, and his influence is more likely to be as far-reaching as that of an important industrialist. The American public may not see him, but that makes the racketeer's power for evil in our society even greater. Lacking the direct confrontation with racketeering, the American citizen fails to see the reason for alarm. The reason decidedly exists The financial cost of organized crime is not limited to the vast illicit profits of gambling or narcotics. When racketeers bore their way into legitimate businesses, the cost is borne by the public. When the infiltration is into labor relations, the racketeer's cut is paid by higher wages and higher prices, in other words, by the public. When the racketeer bribes local officials and secures immunity from police action, the price exacted by corrupt law enforcement, incalculably in dollars, is paid again by the public. In short, organized crime affects everyone. It cannot be the concern only of law enforcement officers. It must be the urgent and active concern of every citizen.
So started what may be the most shocking thriller the Senate Investigations Subcommittee has ever had. After Valachi testifies, if he does, and the presumption is that he will be persuaded, after that, other law enforcement officials and civic leaders will be called upon to talk. They are expected to give city-by-city descriptions of how crime fastens itself upon entire communities, and the communities either can't or won't get out from under the burden. Attorney General Kennedy wants additional wiretapping authority for law enforcement officials. He also would like a law providing immunity for witnesses in criminal investigations. He himself says these criminals must not only be given immunity from prosecution for their own crimes, but they also must be protected, even to the point of sending them and their families out of the country and maintaining them in private hideaways. As was so well pointed out, the official objective is to determine whether more laws are needed. But a more fundamental goal is to make the American public realize what it's up against in highly organized criminal organizations. Unless this is accomplished, according to all the committee officials and witnesses, the investigation will have been a failure. Robert McCormick, NBC Congressional Correspondent.